Well, good morning, everybody, and happy Monday. This is our first Monday episode of Chronicles Magazine podcast. And of course, I'm your host, CJ Engel. I'm delighted to be joined today by James Kalb, who wrote an essay recently in Chronicles Magazine. Of course, he's a friend of Chronicles Magazine. He's written several books that I've read and I recommend, and we'll get to those at the end. But the topic of today's discussion is Paul Elmer Moore. So we'll get into who he was, why he's important, and why he was the subject of a Remembering the Right essay. So good morning, James, and thank you for joining me.
Good morning. It's good to be here.
Before we get into the substance of Moore, let's talk about your background and maybe, you know, what, why did you write on Moore? Because I know how the Remembering the Right series works. Sometimes we suggest someone we want to write about. Sometimes we're asked to do one, but did they ask you to write about Moore? Is that someone that you've read before?
Somebody I read before, and I suggested it. And yeah, Paul was pleased by the idea. You know, he was like a central figure in American conservative thought, to the extent that that was something you could be a central figure in back in the, I don't know, the up to the 30s. Mm-hmm. And as part of a group called the New Humanist, that was more or less the most prominent figure in which was Irving Babbitt, and except he was personally and intellectually quite different. Mm-hmm. So he's an interesting figure from that standpoint.
How do you place the humanists? Where did they come from, and where were they centered geographically and all that?
Gee, they were mostly people from the Midwest who ended up in the East. So it was I guess a social background, sort of like the neoconservatives who started off as people from a non-central background and ended up in the citadel of intellectual power or influence and had to decide what they were going to do about that. But of course, the New Humanists were quite different. There were people who, you know, like classic ideas in learning in life. And they also wanted to be realistic about life in America. And for example, how would you, how do you work democracy? You know, can you have a sort of intellectual aristocracy that lends some guidance, you know, to keep keep things on an even keel, to maintain moderation and continuity, to connect what's happening now to the experience of mankind, and so on. And so those are the political issues they're concerned with. And from an intellectual standpoint, they weren't really traditionalists. They were interested in constructing from observation of experience, a humanistic theory of you know, how we should live our lives, what we should look to, you know, how we should retain good sense and continuity in the middle of change, and so on. Mm-hmm. So they're interesting from that standpoint.
One of the things that we emphasize, you know, at Chronicles is that the old right, one of the features of the old right, you know, before World War II, was that it critiqued the managerial revolution, it critiqued the New Deal and stuff. But these people wrote before the New Deal. So Elmer Moore was born in 1864 and he lived until 1937. So the core of his writing probably was in the teens and 20s and 30s. So this was basically before, with some exception, the New Deal revolution. But they were critiquing the tendencies and trajectories of the American economy and political life even back then. So what was going on back then that would cause them, you know, frustration or, you know, inspire them to write against some of these trends?
Well, pretty much similar trends. There's a tendency toward a technological approach to life. You're supposed to be practical. You weren't supposed to be concerned about aesthetics so much as what was useful. Because you remember before the New Deal, there was like the New Freedom and there's progressivism, all of which you wanted to use science.
Right.
To, you know, readjust, you know, how people live and ways of thought and so on. And, these people, the new humanists, thought that just left out too much because human beings are not the same as the sort of things you study by modern science.
Right.
And so therefore, you have to have a different way of thinking about it.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned early on he spent years in a cabin in Vermont reading Greek and Latin classics. So just absorbing basically the great tradition, the things that pre-existed that were not fashionable maybe in the early 20th century. How do you think that kind of set him on pace for critiquing the American way of life?
Well, a lot of it was sort of self-critique. He started off as a sort of rabid romanticist who, liked to write romantic poetry. And then that didn't seem to work.
Mm-hmm.
And so he started looking for other things, and he became a materialist who wanted to come up with a theory like Democritus, that all there is atoms in the void.
Right.
And that didn't seem sufficient. So then he became, in effect, a Hindu. And, he had this monistic idea of the great soul that I guess Americans can fall prey to. You can find things like that in the Transcendentalists. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what led him to go to Harvard and study Sanskrit, which is where he met Irving Babbitt, who had a much more settled and much more classicizing attitude toward things. They had long arguments, and Babbitt mostly converted Moore and convinced Moore that his education had been lacking because he hadn't studied the classics.
Mm-hmm.
And so I went up to his cabin in Vermont and read the classics for 2 years, the classics meaning the Greek and Roman classics.
Mm-hmm.
And with that, he looked at the academic life, but decided that was becoming, again, sort of too use-oriented. When he was first at Harvard around 1900, I guess in the 1890s, they were having their anti-classics revolution where they were promoting the sciences and the elective system. And he thought that wasn't going to go anywhere because students weren't going to end up with anything very solid or useful. And he thought that the whole vogue for PhDs that started in Germany was ruining the academic life because it made people too specialized, so they couldn't comment on generally useful on things that actually had some human use.
Mm-hmm.
So he didn't go for his PhD. He taught for a couple of years at Harvard and then at Bryn Mawr. And then he set up as a literary critic and made his living that way for about 15 years.
Mm-hmm. It's funny because today we have similar critiques about education, and a lot of people just, I guess, instinctively presume that the things started going downhill in education in the 60s and 70s and 80s, but these are the same critiques that Moore dealt with before the 20th century. I mean, these were the same trends that were happening back then, and he realized that there was something socially and culturally, civilizationally damaging in severing this modernist empire from the deep past.
The more you look at things, the farther back things go. And so again, this very utilitarian engineering approach to things,
mm-hmm,
really was taking off in American life in the second half of the 19th century, it was really conquering the heights like Harvard by the time you got to the 1890s.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, it goes way back.
Yeah, and he recognized that early on. And he actually, you can kind of see his progression as he writes his like 4-volume work on the great Greek tradition and then the Romans. And he actually, as you said, started off as a materialist, and then he found Plato. And so he admitted the spiritual world, but he kept going and realized that it all culminated for him in this acceptance of Christianity that he was sort of forced to accept.
Yeah, no, he really thought his way into it and lived, mm-hmm, his way into it.
Do you think his academic work on the historical development of thought was sort of a personal struggle for him?
Well,
in other words, as he studied the development of thought, he himself followed with the long train.
Well, yeah, as the sensitive traced things to it, to their causes,
mm-hmm.
and traced out their implications, you know, that obviously had a big effect on his outlook on things.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, how do you bring it all together? You know, as I think I suggested, this about dialectic, where you start from manicist, then you turn into a materialist, then you turn into a Hindu, then you turn into a Platonist, because that somehow brings together the material and the spiritual through the theory of the forms. And then you decide that, well, it has to get a little bit more real than that, and which is where Christianity and the doctrine of the incarnation is all right. about. You know, he has like that 4 or 5 volume. You can work on the Greek tradition, which is really about the doctrine of the incarnation.
Mm-hmm.
And how Platonic thought really ended up with the Council of Chalcedon.
Right.
Which is it's rather interesting. Yeah, he tries to you know, boil things down to what the most important points were as he sees them. And it's really fairly interesting. It's worth reading.
You know, so in reading the Greeks and absorbing them, he really held on to Plato in a way that he wouldn't for like someone like Aristotle. And he was somewhat critical of like the Catholic Aristotelianism. Is that right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. He thought it tried to explain too much.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he liked Plato because Plato used myths and Plato was a poet. And also there's this feature in Plato about the one and the many, and the confusion of sensible experience in the ideal forms, and how do you bring that together? And both are real.
Mm-hmm.
That was important to him to admit that there's a point beyond which you really can't sort things out and come up with some absolute answer.
Right.
You know, you can get reliable answers that you can count on, but there's always going to be something that escapes us. And that was a very important principle for him.
Mm-hmm. Do you think in his critique of the 20th century, or what would be the 20th century, do you think he came across, do you think his contemporaries saw him as like just curmudgeonly?
There were different views. I think H.L. Mencken, you know, complained about him. And one thing he complained about was that he wasn't really polemical.
Mm-hmm.
And another thing he complained about was the classicism. But he also said that Moore was really the nearest thing America had to a scholar.
Yeah,
because you know, Moore had such broad and deep interests and took it all seriously and worked his way through it.
Mm-hmm.
So there was that. Yeah, he struggled for influence because the times were against him.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the 30s came along and, you know, people thought we have all these economic problems and look at what's going on in Europe. And so why do we need to read Cicero?
Right, you exactly, know? Right.
It didn't seem... Yeah, and
but he wasn't stationed at, was he stationed at a university at all, or was he completely independent?
He was basically independent. After he, you know, stopped being the literary critic for The Nation, he actually moved to Princeton, New Jersey.
Mm-hmm.
Not because he had a position with Princeton, but because it was a nice place to live, and he liked the house that he could buy there.
So he basically funded himself purely on just his writing.
That's right. Yeah. Writing, lecturing. He would also get academic gigs, which I guess must have paid a bit more than sure. adjunct professors get these days.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he'd go out to Berkeley and lecture for a semester or whatever.
Right.
But yeah, he did support himself pretty well on his writing.
Yeah.
And lecturing and you know, sort of sporadic positions, doing something or another at universities. At Princeton, for example, they eventually realized, well, we have this guy here. We can have him teach all sorts of graduate seminars.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it was informal enough at the time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so they could engage him to do that. And, mm-hmm. You know, the students would come over to his house and talk to them about, I don't know, Plato or the Hellenistic philosophies or whatever.
Right.
And, you know, so that would have brought in some money as well.
He would not have been a friend of mass democracy. He didn't put a lot of faith in the ability of the masses to guide society in the right direction.
No, well, that's right. I mean, he thought that we needed some sort of accepted intellectual aristocracy. He thought if things were working right, you'd have people like Washington. He also thought highly of Lincoln as a man of vision and moderation. Had a pretty good idea of what the political situation demanded. Mm-hmm. Was able to calm passions and sort of raise enthusiasm when he had to. So he had some hope that you could have a democracy or a system that was based on voting. Mm-hmm. That would also recognize people who had merit as leaders. Right. And there are some examples he could point to.
So he wouldn't have been like a modern egalitarian type where everybody has, everyone's voice is equal. You know, he did see an intellectual aristocracy as needing to guide the people.
Well, yeah. Yeah. That, the people have to recognize that there are some people who know more than they do. And mm-hmm. there are people they can. And of course, that's always true anyway. I mean, there were public figures that people rely on. Right. Maybe it's just Taylor Swift or somebody. But always going to be somebody that people look to and form their opinions on. And he thought that tendency could be, could be effective even in a democracy. Mm-hmm. If you had the right people who were rightly educated and lived admirable lives.
Right.
So that everybody would say, oh, yeah, this guy, we got to listen to what he has to say.
How would you compare his instincts, his political instincts, to someone like Edmund Burke?
He admired Burke a lot. The instincts are very similar. Burke put a lot more emphasis on tradition as such, mm-hmm. which Moore, as an American, was not in a position to do. He thought that Burke was moderate, had a broad vision of things. You understood when he had to do something when you're better off leaving things alone. Mm-hmm. So that, he admired Burke. He just lived in a very different sort of country. Mm-hmm.
And he saw tradition as something that was important in sustaining, cultural continuity and stability over time. But he recognized that America was unique and it didn't necessarily have those roots in a connected institutional way.
Yeah, it wasn't like Europe at all.
Right.
He liked England. Mm-hmm. Yeah. At one point late in his life, he said, gee, maybe after I quit being a critic, I should have moved to England.
T.S. Eliot.
It's just a different country. And so you have to deal with things differently. I mean, that's what being prudent is all about. You you understand what your circumstances are and you relate those somehow or other. Mm-hmm. To like permanently important considerations, and you do the best you can.
Yeah. Is there any obvious differences between he and Babbitt that are worth talking about?
Politically, they're very similar. They're intellectually very different. Moore was much more religious. One problem Babbitt had was that his father was a religious crank. Mm-hmm. Who apparently is still remembered by people who are into, I don't know, magnetism or something like that. And so that sort of put Babbitt off religion permanently.
Okay. But Babbitt did influence more toward Christianity, though, too, right?
So certainly away from Hinduism and towards something that's more identifiably Western and based on the classic tradition, which Moore ended up thinking Christianity really very much was. Mm-hmm. He thought that, as mentioned, Chalcedon was a culmination of Plato.
Right.
That it took a wrong turn with Plotinus, and Aristotle had the wrong idea, but
right.
Chalcedon was really the way you make the best use of what Plato can tell us.
What role did Moore see Christianity playing? I mean, you talked about how we all need something to guide our lives and to give us meaning and fulfillment, and to sort of order us, not only individually, but also as communities towards something higher. Is that the basic function of Christianity in his mind?
Well, there's a need for guidance, but there's also the idea that it's good to lay on to what's real. Mm-hmm. He was seriously religious. He had a deep skeptical streak. And just because of his cast of mind, I think I mentioned that his commitment, he has a very hard time making his commitment quite to Christianity, quite as complete as maybe would have been good. Mm-hmm. But, you have to bring your life into order. And the way you bring your life into order is by looking at what's really real and trying to form yourself on that. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't, it wasn't at all a utilitarian approach. He thought I mean, obviously, if you don't have religion, you're going to have big problems. But that wasn't the basic idea.
Okay. Was he institutionally committed to any, was like the Catholic Church or any Protestant tradition?
Sort of high church Anglicanism, except that he never really was, he started off Presbyterian mm-hmm. at home. And then when he was a teenager, he decided he didn't believe in any of that, or okay. at least in enough of it or something. And, then he was attracted to, the Anglican tradition, I guess, because in the first place, it's not quite so absolute as the Catholic Church is, but they did carry forward the sacraments, which were important for him,
right?
And also the basic creeds and doctrines, which were also extremely important to him.
Mm-hmm.
And I think like on his deathbed, like he would attend Anglican or Episcopalian, I guess, in this country, services, but I don't think he ever received communion until he was on his deathbed. And I don't think it was actually confirmed.
Mm-hmm.
So that, he had a, he was sort of committed to Anglicanism, but that tradition, but not completely, which maybe fits the tradition.
Yeah. And it's hard. It was probably harder to do that, in early 20th century America, to be, committed in that way to institutional Anglicanism. Especially with his background in St. Louis. Is that where he was born, St. Louis?
I think. Yeah, St. Louis, yeah.
Right.
Everybody came from St. Louis.
Yeah.
Yes, Eliot, Paul Abner Moore.
Right. So Moore, he did see Christianity as something that would sustain the West, and it was needed because you needed something deeper and more specific than Plato's religious myths. Plato talked about the importance of religious myths and binding community, but Moore pointed out that you needed something more specific for that thing to be lasting.
Well, yeah, he became aware of the problem, which is also a problem with somebody like Richard Weaver.
Mm-hmm.
That, yeah, you can talk about the moral imagination and all that, and it's all very nice, but who does that work for?
Mm-hmm.
It's like the comment... if it's just a symbol, to hell with it. So that he became more aware of that as time went on.
So for him, for a religion that would be lasting, it would need the component of divine revelation that Christianity brings.
He thought divine revelation was necessary. That. And also, it just made sense. I mean, you have to somehow rescue God from being just a concept.
Mm-hmm.
If it's the most real, if he's the most real being, then that just can't be just a theory, and it has to manifest himself. And he was a little bit chary about committing himself fully to that. For example, he thought that the resurrection was real, but not exactly physical.
Mm-hmm.
He thought he liked to point at Paul's experience on the road to Damascus that, there was something real going on here, but it wasn't like a flesh and blood man showing up and saying, "Hi, I'm Jesus. Why are you doing this stuff?" It was just a certain reluctance. He just had a very critical way of looking at things, which, of course, is great in a critic.
Mm-hmm.
It's not going to make him a morally religious leader, except for a few intellectuals.
Right, right. You draw a number of parallels between his tendency and thought and Pascal's. Maybe comment on that a little bit.
Sure. Your basic, both of them basically start off with this skeptical, analytical, modern view and what that does to the world.
Mm-hmm.
But then you take that skeptical, analytical view and you apply it more broadly and say, what is my situation? What do I know? How do I come to know anything? I can't avoid thinking I know some things because I have to live.
Mm-hmm.
And in order to live at all, I have to act as if some things are true. And I'm not only going to act that way, I'm actually going to believe it.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you decide what things are true? And there you get into this process of saying, well, how can I best make sense of life as I find it? You know, there's a bunch of different views, some of them sort of scant. You know, leave out aspects of experience. You can point to materialism. How does that explain how we have consciousness?
Mm-hmm.
It's this process of you're asking yourself, how do I explain all this? How do I make sense of all this? Because I have to make some sort of sense of it because of the sheer necessity of doing something rather than something else.
Mm-hmm.
And, both of them ended up with Christianity as the result of all that. Pascal in a more thoroughgoing way.
Right.
Than Moore. A different sort of mind altogether.
Right. Why do you think there's no books? I mean, you can find them online and stuff, but why is he neglected today?
I don't know. He's very idiosyncratic.
Right.
Like some people contrast him to somebody like C.S. Lewis, who is also very literary and scholarly and ended up in Christianity because that's how you can make sense of life, the world as you find it. But in the first place, Lewis was more thoroughgoing in what he was willing to do intellectually. He mm-hmm. was able to commit more fully. And, Moore, he's a good critic. I mean, you read his criticism, his literary criticism, and it's very good. Sort of analyzing, well, here's this writer, and where does he stand in relation to other writers, and what does he do really well, and so on. But, that maintains this sort of analytical weighing and judging
mm-hmm.
approach, which does come to conclusions, but that's not in the long run what people are looking for in a religious thinker, they want to help them with that really basic commitment that tells them what the world's like and what they should do.
Mm-hmm.
And so... his criticism, he's not one of the absolutely top critics, like, I don't know, T.S. Eliot or somebody. Mm-hmm. He's very good, but not someone who affected the outlook on literature enough to make people right. go back and reread them. And as a religious thinker, he's a bit too tentative and idiosyncratic.
Right. So... I like your quote in here in the essay when he says of himself that he's at once the least read and most hated author in existence. So he recognized, he didn't have much of an influence. Did he sound regretful about that at all when he was writing this? Or was this
a wry humor?
Yeah.
I don't know. Like I said, toward the end of his life, he said, gee, maybe I should have gone off and lived in England.
Right.
I... And generally, he was happy with his life. He had good friends. He married well. He had good relations with his family. He lived a materially comfortable life. There's certainly plenty of things that fascinated him about life, letters, the world. It's very much the opposite of a failure, except to the extent that everybody fails and in sort of an ultimate way.
Does he come across as optimistic or pessimistic for the future, from his own standpoint in the early 20th century?
He doesn't show his hand much on that.
Mm-hmm.
He seems to say, well, here's how we can do better than we're doing.
Yeah.
He doesn't say, oh, the university system and public life is all going to hell and there's no way it's ever going to get better.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he's more interested in, well, what could you do about this?
Mm-hmm. Did he spend a lot of time elaborating on, deep systemic or cultural problems in America that could be, really bad for civilization?
I want to describe him that way. Mm-hmm. The idea that people pay too much attention to practicality and toward sentiment rather than judgment were basic issues for him.
Mm-hmm.
He thought that there was a way out. He didn't have any theory of history that told him, oh no, this isn't going to work. It's just going to get worse forever. That wasn't his view. Maybe to that extent, his sort of analytical approach, helped him because it meant that he couldn't get too down in the dumps because of some grand theory, because there are going to be problems with that grand theory as well.
Yeah. What would he have said about the rise of digital media and, corresponding electronically and all of that? Would those things have bolstered his confidence in the academy or undermined it?
Probably undermined it because it causes everything to lose definition.
Mm-hmm.
Discussions never seem to stay on point because the connection, the human connection, is just not very solid. Anybody can always be replaced instantly by somebody else who lives in a different part of the world because it's just so easy to connect and disconnect.
Yeah.
The ability to manipulate electronic presentations.
Yeah.
You can make anything look like anything. I doubt that he would have seen grounds for optimism in that.
Right. There's one quote that you have here in your essay. It says, "Our people generally are more interested in safety and comfort and our elites in wealth and power than in Platonic myths, the inner check, the moral imagination." So it strikes me in reading that sentence that, we're not set up as we are right now to revive civilization, but we're going to keep in a state of degradation sort of if we don't, reawaken our own ability to connect with the past and the Platonic myths and religion.
Right now it seems that the important thing is to keep as much going as we can to connect with each other and sort of counter networks. I mean, the sort of thing that Chronicles, for example, is trying to do,
mm-hmm.
A place where you can have discussions about what's going on and certain sorts of ideas about what to do about it can be developed.
Mm-hmm.
It seems at present civilization is more a matter of small groups.
Right.
Than of grand trends. You can't leave out grand trends altogether. Every now and then you see something optimistic about, well, maybe really we really can do something about architecture.
Yeah.
To make it less horrible because everybody knows it's horrible. So you ought to be able to get some public support.
Yeah.
For
I think a lot of people who've looked up, more, they don't know where to start with him because his books are hard to find. They can find digital copies of them. But if you had to start somewhere, would you start with, maybe you would start with Babbitt or something just to familiarize yourself with humanism, but where would you start in investigating this world?
Well, Babbitt has more of a coherent view. mm-hmm. a more of a uniform, coherent view. So from that standpoint, he might be a better person to start with.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, I guess it depends more on interests. If you're interested in literature, you can read some of his criticism, see what he says about authors that you like.
Those would be in the Shelbourne essays, is that right?
Yeah, Shelbourne, New Shelbourne essays.
Right, and those came out in the over the course of what, the 20s and 30s? Or?
Yeah, the teens and 20s. Okay. I think going to the 30s, it was the New Shelbourne essays.
Okay, is there a content or flavor difference between those?
The fact that it's New Shelbourne essays just means that it's a different series from a publication standpoint.
Right, right.
It's not like he starts on page one and says, I hereby reject all that junk I said.
Right.
Back in the Shelbourne essays. To me, it's fairly similar, content. His thought does develop. So if you're interested in literature, you could read some of his criticism. If you're interested in various aspects of religion, you could look at like the skeptical approach to religion, which goes into his sort of Pascal-like.
Would you consider him difficult to read?
His criticism is not difficult. I wouldn't say he's difficult. You have to be somewhat aware of the stuff he's writing about. Mm-hmm. He's not an introductory writer.
Mm-hmm.
You have to know something about what he's writing about. I mean, if you want to read what he says about Samuel Johnson, it'll be helpful to have read Samuel Johnson before.
Right.
To already have somewhat of an interest in that writer.
You mentioned that people like Kirk tried to revive him.
But
he didn't really catch on even after Kirk talked about him.
Yeah. Kirk pumped him up, the greatest Christian apologist of the 20th century.
Was that in the conservative mind or was that elsewhere?
I think it was the conservative mind. I think that's where it is.
Was he one of the figures?
I believe that, as I recall, it's been a while since I've looked at Kirk.
Yeah.
But my recollection is that, he was one of the figures that Kirk focused on early on.
Mm.
Not that he abandoned him later, but,
right.
If he wanted to stitch together a conservative tradition in America that nobody had noticed before, Moore would be one of the guys you had put into it.
Yeah. With his critique of like technocracy and the coming managerialism in the early 20th century, do you think he would have been surprised at the difficulties we're facing today?
No. Idea that things can be managed when they really can't.
Mm-hmm.
And that if you want to know what to do in Afghanistan, you just ask the social scientists.
Right, right.
That's ridiculous.
Would that be the basic thrust of humanism, is just understanding the limits and constraints of man?
Certainly, that's an important thrust. And, there's that aspect. You really can't manage human life. You can do better. Mm-hmm. It's possible to see it as more of a whole and to, pick out the things that are likely to continue and to be dominant.
Mm-hmm.
And not be too much impressed by particular new theories that come along.
Yeah.
The new humanism wanted to develop steady judgment is kind of something people could have in public life.
Yeah.
The ability to think clearly, to express themselves clearly, to think about things steadily and with a lot of perspective.
Mm-hmm.
So they wouldn't get carried away by some fantasy that they're going to be able to do this, that something's going to be more catastrophic than it really was. Although they did recognize catastrophes. Mm-hmm. For example, in the 20s, Irving Babbitt was predicting how there was going to be this huge war of racial extermination in the Pacific, and that he reads about this atomic energy stuff, and that's going to be turned into bombs. And so that... so that apparently studying the classics did help you see the direction things would likely go.
Yeah.
A lot of it's just moderation.
Right.
Good sense of moderation.
It really seems like they, a key component of their contributions was to call out the hubris of man. There's just this tendency, especially in America in the 20th century, that we can make the world a better place and we can use our expertise, our science, to basically help overcome the past and to bring us forth into a better world. And I think the humanists, especially with Moore, would have called balderdash on that whole enterprise.
Absolutely. Yeah. Times do change, but there's a limit to how much they change because there's a lot of basic things that are still the way they were 2,000 years ago.
Yeah. So if I were to ask you what your favorite piece of literary criticism from Moore would be, does anything come to mind?
Gee, that's a good question because, he's so varied. I think The Demon of the Absolute is sort of useful for understanding something about his outlook on things.
Is that an essay on?
It's an essay on, people tendency to make categorical judgments.
Mm-hmm.
That has this high philosophical implications, like you saw in Aristotle, who was trying to get too much of a comprehensive theory, but also into everyday judgments, where he talks about some literary critics who...
Is that a book or is that an essay?
It's an essay. Yeah, a long essay. There's, I think, one of the Shelbourne, volume of the Shelbourne essays. It includes it. It's rather long. That's worth... Let me take a look just a second if...
Yeah, you take a look at that, but I think I recall seeing that one. I the title somewhere, and it always struck me: "The Demon in the Absolute."
Yeah, the Demon of the Absolute. Absolute. Yeah.
Okay, and he does. Yeah. And he does have some good essays on like Samuel Johnson and people like that.
Absolutely. And first, you could read him on natural aristocracy, and but those aren't exactly literary essays. You know, they do touch on. He believed in life and letters.
Yeah,
the point of literature is that tells us something about life, and really ought to relate to our concerns in living.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know if somebody wanted to explore his criticism. I'd say reconcile yourself to reading something on a tablet.
Yeah, there you go. All right, my last question is this. He was part of the Remembering the Right series. So what makes him, what about him would make you consider him a person on the right?
Well, he thought there were limits in life, that progressivism doesn't really progress all that much because he keeps sliding back, and that... you needed to be aware of permanent considerations. You need to be aware of the Western tradition of what has been achieved and the importance of constantly going back to that or maintaining an awareness of that.
Mm-hmm.
And also he emphasized things like discipline, judgment, private property, at least on a small scale. So that, it's definitely anti-progressive,
mm-hmm.
and pro-stability. And so from that standpoint, you'd put them on the right.
Well, good. Well, I would encourage people to subscribe to Chronicles Magazine so that you can get these Remembering the Right essays as part of it. And I think, when was yours? Yours was a couple months ago, right?
It's in December.
December. Okay, yeah. So Remembering Paul Elmer Moore. I appreciate your time, and everyone should read, pick up a subscription and read the essay, because he's a fascinating person to get into, just from understanding, our own, Greek here, there's an aspect of the West that emphasizes, our Greek philosophical heritage, and Moore spent a lot of years pulling that out. So I think it's important that people familiarize yourselves with him. So thank you for your time today, and we'll have you come on again? Because I think you have another. Didn't you have another?
Yeah, one Fedor. On? Yeah, yeah. It wasn't quite double barreled, but because it was a month between them. But
who was it? Oh, it was Danoche, right?
Augusto Danoche.
Yeah. So we'll have you on to discuss him soon. But thank you for your time today.
Okay. Good to be with you.